Hello and welcome to episode 3 of the Park From It podcast. My name is Leo Gorman, and in this edition I'll be talking to Alexander Rossi, currently driving in the World Series by Renault Championship, about his season so far as well as his prospects for the future. And I'll also be chatting to John Hindhoff, presenter of Radio Le Mans and Midweek Motorsport, about the Le Mans 24 Hours, the recent Nürburgring life of 24 Hours, as well as the Imola 6 Hours, which is coming up this weekend. All this coming up in the next hour in Park From It. The 2010 World Series by Renault Championship gave us something of an intriguing season. It was a title battle that went on between three drivers, eventual champion Michael Aleixin, who went on to drive in GP2 for a short period before having to change down to Formula 3 in Germany for budgetary reasons, runner-up driver Daniel Ricciardo, who is continuing in the World Series by Renault Championship this year while also doing occasional Friday morning sessions for Toro Rosso, and Esteban Guerrieri, who came third and is currently challenging in the Indy Lights Championship in America. 2011 is proving to be more of the same. The championship currently headed by Canadian Robert Wickens, who has taken 2 wins this season, but has also scored 4 second places as well as a 5th. It leads him 30 points ahead of 2nd place Kevin Kurios, who is a graduate of the Formula 2 Eurocup Championship. Kurios has taken 3 wins, including the last race at Nürburgring, to take him level on points with Jean-Éric Vergne, who happens to be another one of the seemingly endless Red Bull junior drivers. Vergne has taken 1 race win this year, but has kind of tailed off somewhat in the last few races as he fights for his battle after winning British Formula 3 in 2010. Fourth in the championship is Danny Ricciardo. The Toro Rosso reserve actually missed the first round earlier on this year due to duties with the team in China. And he has since taken 2 wins, one at Monaco and one at Monza, as well as a 2nd place at the Nürburgring and several other points finishes, to leave him some 43 points behind Wickens in the championship. It's going to be a tough battle for Ricciardo to pull himself back up the table, and it's also rumoured that he may be missing the last round of the championship should Toro Rosso recall him again. However, also hanging over Ricciardo's head is the possibility that he may be brought up to drive the Formula 1 team proper during the season, should the team wish to cut ties with either Sebastian Buemi or Hami Alguazhari. Fifth in the title is Albert Acosta. Albert Acosta, who's done quite well this season, he scored several points finishes and a couple of podiums, and realistically not a championship challenger, but it's still a decent prospect for the future. Next up, Alexander Rossi, who started the season so well in a victory at Aragon, but has since had a few problems. He's taken 2 podiums, a couple of points finishes, but has retired from the last 3 races, and that leaves him 59 points behind championship leader Robert Wickens. The next World Series by Renault round is this weekend at the Hungaroring just outside Budapest. Tickets for the event are free. All you have to do is just go into the World Series by Renault website and just apply for tickets, print them out, go to the circuit, you get in. The access is absolutely brilliant. It's well worth a watch, and it's a fantastic series of races as well. Well worth even just the travel money. There are further races so later on in the year at Silverstone, Paul Ricard, and the final round will be in Barcelona. Joining me on the Park From It podcast now is World Series by Renault driver Alexander Rossi. The Fortec Motorsport driver is currently 6th in the championship. Alexander, welcome to the show. How are you getting on?
Thank you for having me. Yeah, it was good. Just finished the training session at Pro Performance down near Gatwick in the UK, so all was good.
Of course, we know you so far from your World Series by Renault drives, but also, but before that, tell us about your career so far. Tell us about yourself. How did you get to this point?
Yeah, I started off in karts in America. Did about 2.5 karting, and then I moved into Formula BMW, which is quite an entry level junior formula. And did that for 2 years in the States, and then came home to Europe for the first time in 2009 and competed in International Formula Master. And then in 2010 did GP3, which was a new series created at the beginning of 2010 to be the sister series to GP2. And then from there, I moved to World Series by Renault for this year.
And of course, course, before you actually went into the Formula BMW USA Series in 2007, you were running in the Skip Barber National Championships. You actually achieved an incredibly prestigious award. You became the youngest ever champion of that series at the age of 14. That must have been an incredibly proud moment for you.
Yes, yes, that's correct. And it was that was really my first foray into Formula cars, and really taught me the basics and taught me what was necessary in order to drive Formula cars. And it was definitely the building blocks to my career. And that started at quite a young age, and was definitely a good result to achieve. And it was a big confidence booster for me moving into BMW.
Of course, after you won the Formula BMW Championships in 2008 and the World Championship thereafter in the Formula BMW Series, that earned you a test with what was then the BMW Sauber team. Was that really the moment it kind of clicked that, you know, maybe Formula One isn't just a dream, it isn't just like a distant possibility, that it is something that could actually happen to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think winning the World Finals in 2008 was kind of my debut onto the European radar. And it really forced me to get over to Europe in 2009 to compete on an international level and to compete in the European Series, which is so necessary in order to get into Formula One. And then the Sauber test, the BMW Sauber test at the end of 2009 was really icing on the cake and was an amazing experience for me and was very successful and really just gave me a taste of what F1 was about, and with that came a lot of motivation to attain that goal.
And of course, after you won the World Championship prize with the Formula BMW USA Series, you went on to compete in International Formula Master, and from there you did GP2 Asia and GP3 in 2010, and now you're in the World Series by Renault Championship this year. And of course, you've picked up one win earlier on this season at Aragon and a couple of other podiums, but you've had a few retirements since then. But even just looking at a championship from this distance, it seems like an incredibly different prospect. There's an awful lot of drivers there who could be with you in Formula 1 in a few years' time, such as Daniel Ricciardo, Jean-Éric Vergne, Kevin Kouras, or Albert Costa. Just tell us about the difficulty of that series. How tough is it?
Yeah, it is. I think World Series is as competitive, if not more, than GP2 this year, and it's been really highly recognized in the motorsport community. And I'm very happy to be a part of it. And the results have been good. And, you know, just a bit of unfortunate luck lately. But the pace has always been there. And, you know, we're just at the halfway point to the season. And the goal is to still win a championship for sure. So, you know, it's going to take a lot of hard work on everyone's part. But we're definitely up to the challenge. And, you know, look forward to the next remaining four rounds.
And of course, it is incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to have an entire season that doesn't have bumps somewhere along the way. And of course, you've just had retirements in Monaco in the two races at Nürburgring. It's left you 58 points behind Robert Wickens in the table. With that in mind, just how do you approach the last four rounds of the season? Is this still a championship challenge, or is this a case of learning as much as possible and just gaining the points along the way, just gaining the right knowledge?
No, it's definitely realistically challenging for the title, and that's been our goal since one, and that will remain our goal. There's a lot of racing and a lot of points still to be gained. Like I said, we're just at the halfway point through the season, so you know, it has been a bit of a bumpy road. But with that being said, the pace is there. I'm very happy with the team, and we just need a bit of luck to roll our way, to be honest. And, you know, going into Budapest in a week and a half, I have a lot of confidence that that track, the team won there last year, and, you know, we're definitely going to be pushing for a good result. And at the end of the day, that's all we need. We just need a bit of momentum to work in our direction, and I think we'll be good to go.
Something that has become vastly apparent in junior formulas, especially in the last few years, has been the presence of manufacturers of Formula One teams in the likes of GP2, GP3, and of course World Series, and various other formulas, junior formulas around the world. We see an awful lot of, you know, Red Bull have their huge junior driver program as they keep searching for young drivers to bring into Formula One. Mauricio Virgin have, you know, various programs throughout junior series, and of course Renault a very much a presence in the lower categories as well. And of course, in April, you were actually announced as the lead driver for Team Lotus's junior driver development program. What kind of pressures does this put on your shoulders? What kind of responsibilities are expected of you? And how do you feel now that you do have something of a link, a direct link to your ultimate goal, which is Formula One?
Yeah, I mean, obviously having a link with the Formula One team is a great, great thing to have for any driver, any young driver looking to get into Formula One, as it adds a lot of credibility to your resume and really brings attention to what you're trying to do. And with that does come added pressure, but, you know, like you said, the Ricciardo, Vern, Wickens, and myself, we all have F1 ties, and all of us are really in the same position. We all have to basically win this year. And, you know, that's just what motor racing is about. Each year the stakes get higher, and, this year in World Series is quite high. And like I said, there's four of us that all have an F1 relationship, and we're all pushing very hard to get there in the near future.
Earlier on this year, you also joined the FIA Global Driver Academy, which is a kind of a search to find the next upcoming pilots and really train them properly for Formula One, where not just physical, but also other attributes as well. What does that entail, and what does that offer you as a driver, and what do you think it can offer other drivers in the future?
The FIA Institute created this program as a way to really get young drivers who are on the verge of making it into the higher levels of F1 and World Rally Championship, and just teaching them the finer details that may have gotten missed along the way, definitely in terms of off-track, physical fitness, mental capabilities, performance management, and just really showing us all the big picture. And on top of that, there's technical briefings with the likes of Mercedes engineers, and there's a bit of time you get to spend in cars trying out different techniques that you might not get to try on an actual racetrack in a race car. So there's a lot of benefits to it, and obviously being a part of the program and being recognized by the FIA is something that is a great honor for me to have.
And of course, Alexander, you'll be in the Hungaroring on the 2nd and 3rd of July for the next round of the World Series by Renault Championship. For those listeners who are looking to go to this round and maybe even other rounds later on this year, you just go on to the World Series by Renault website. I cannot remember the address off the top of my head, but I do believe it might be worldseriesbyrenault.com. Apply for tickets. They're absolutely free. I believe you just download them from the website, and it's fantastic access to what is an incredibly exciting and thoroughly enjoyable series. And of course, after the Hungaroring this weekend, there is going to be Silverstone, there's Barcelona at the end of the year, and
Paul Ricard.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, Paul Ricard. Yes, excellent. Cheers. Thank you very much for coming on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on, and hopefully we'll see you on the winner step sometime very soon. Cheers. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
And thanks again to Alexander Rossi for joining me on the Park from a podcast. And also a big thanks as well to Emma Buxton for arranging the interview. Once again, World Series by Renault. Just go to the website, check out for tickets. They are free. They're brilliant races and a fantastic championship to follow. One event that was in the news recently for both the right and wrong reasons was the 24-hour race at Le Mans. The race was won by Audi Sport Team Jos with Michael Fassler, André Lotterer and Benoit Trullier at the wheel. They beat Sébastien Bourdais, Simon Pagenaud and Pedro Lamy's Team Peugeot Total car across the line after 24 hours by just a mere 13 seconds. The news was also in the race for two incredible smashes for both Alan McNish and Mike Rockenfeller in the other two Audi machines that I'm sure will go into YouTube lore forever and ever and ever. Thankfully, absolutely no one was injured. Well, not seriously. I think there was a few cuts and bruises and scrapes and whatnot, but other than that, the drivers walked away absolutely fine. There were no injuries that we know of to the crowds, photographers, marshals. Apparently, there was a broken mobile phone, and that's pretty much the limit that we know so far. But again, incredible race. Audi Peugeot separated by very, very little come the end of the race. And really, after 24 hours, to have just 13 seconds between them is an incredible feat. Bravo to all those involved. They really did put on an absolutely incredible show. Aston Martin, unfortunately, did not have the best returns to Le Mans. They were struggling for pace all the way through practice and qualifying, and both machines retiring very, very, very early on in the running. They will not be running in Imola this weekend. They also actually missed Spa earlier on this year. They are doing more testing. Hopefully we will see them on track again later in the season at Silverstone. I'm going to just quickly run through some other category winners while I'm here. The LMP2 class was won by Greaves Motorsport with Callum Oye, Olivier Lombard and Tom Kimber-Smith. They came in at 326 laps, while the LMGTE Pro category was won by Corvette Racing with Olivier Beretta, Tommy Milner and Antonio Garcia taking the honours there. The GTE AM category, which is a category made up of at least two amateurs and one professional driver, that was taken by Labour Competition. That was with Patrick Bonhauser, Julian Cannell and Gabriel Gardel at the wheel of the machine. Of course, Le Mans wasn't the only 24-hour race this month. There was also the 24 Hours of Nordschleife. It was the 39th running of the race. It was won by the Porsche 997 GT3 drivers of Mark Lean, Timo Bernhardt, Romain Dumas and Lucas Lure. It actually brings Timo Bernhardt onto the five-time winners list, along with Pedro Lamy and Marcel Thiemann. Both Lieb and Dumas have become four-time winners of the event, while Lucas Lure picked up his second Nordschleife win. And with all that in mind, it's time to introduce our second guest to this evening's show.
And a big welcome to the Park From It podcast to Radio Le Mans and Midweek Motorsport presenter John Hindhoff. John, it's been a hectic couple of weekends. You were just back from the Nürburgring 24 Hours. How are you feeling?
Two long weekends, in fact, yes. A couple of weekends with 24-hour races involved in them. Obviously, the Le Mans 24 Hours is much more like a week or 10 days now, and then just with one weekend in the middle, it was back out for the Nürburgring. But we're pretty well practiced at it now, and we've got a good team to support us, so it kind of happens, you know.
And it was another victory for Porsche, their fifth in 6 years, and of course it's a record equaling fifth win for Timo Bernhardt as well.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it? Porsche, the most successful manufacturer in the great German race. Timo, having won three on the bounce, four on the bounce, and you know he's clearly got a real feel for that race. You've got to say, obviously, with Olaf Manthey, the Manthey Motorsport organisation is it couldn't be any more local to the track. They actually drive the cars there. They don't even trailer them. And if they need to, they take them back down to Gottlieb Daimlerstrasse, which is just where you go on to do your tourist laps. They've got a big showroom and a workshop there. And those guys, more than anything else, I think, know how to get a car to the finish, to the point where Porsche themselves try not to compete against them now. You'll have noticed the last couple of years, Manthey have run the hybrid there on behalf of Porsche Motorsport. And we've even got our GT3Rs and RSRs, which have an MR suffix to them to stand for Manthey Racing, because they are the kings of the ring, no doubt.
Porsche weren't completely without their problems either. Lucas Lure had an issue in the pit lane when there was a fuel pump failure and they lost something like a minute 15. And of course, all fairness to the BMW squad, who, you know, after 24 hours at the Nordschleife, were only 4 minutes 20 adrift. But at the same time, you cannot take this away from Porsche, who really look like they have not only that circuit, but the formula in that place sorted.
Well, yeah, and don't forget as well that the Manthey team had another car, which they withdrew quite early on in the race. They were looking at both of them in race conditions. Some discussion about whether the car that they actually withdrew had a problem, or whether they were just looking at fuel consumption or pace or what the driver said in race conditions. But whatever, they decided to concentrate on the 18 car, the final winner, and obviously that seemed to be a pretty sensible thing to do. And the other side of that is, let's not forget, Charlie Lam and Schnitzer BMW, winners of the race last year, could have repeated. The winning margin was about the same amount of time, or perhaps even a little less, than they lost by when Pedro Lamy went off at the carousel, spent a bit of time getting back on again, and then, of course, they had a three-minute stop-go for going in the wrong direction down the around the racetrack for that. So, you know, it was half a lap at the end. It could have been even closer than that. Of course, what we don't know is exactly what the Manti Porsche squad had in hand to be able to push a little bit harder, whether required. It seemed to me, though, and we've seen this before, that the BMW try to apply a little bit of pressure. There does seem to be a slight, very slight weakness in the drivetrains of the Porsches. We saw that even 2 years ago with the winning car. It came in and spent quite a lot of time in the pits before it went back out again. And I just wonder what sort of a result we might have had without the problems to the BMW. And we should mention as well, of course, the phenomenal pace of the farm-backer Ferrari on Hankook tyres, taking pole position in the first practice session with a time that was a second quicker than the pole that was set last year. They had a small suspension failure, cost them four laps, but obviously four laps around there is, what, 40-odd minutes? And really, they never recovered after that. They were still one of the quickest things on the track. But it's the level of competition now on the Nürburgring 24 is such that when you lose that kind of time, then it's nigh on impossible to get back. They dropped well down into the hundreds, got back up into the top 10. But let's not forget, with the Manti boys as well, and the BMWs, they both gambled massively at the start of the race. BMW is on cut slicks, and the Manti team on slick tyres, and they dropped down to 43rd at the end of the first lap. Not as bad as what they did a few years ago, when, if you remember, they had the Buster radiator after an incident on the first lap and then came back to win. It wasn't quite as a phenomenal rise to the victory as it had been. I just think what we've seen in this race over the last few years is the uptake in manufacturer interest. And, you know, when you've got people like Olaf Manti, you've got Charlie Lam, you've got whatever the Audi boys say, and congrats to them, by the way, for sweeping the podium in their category, the GT3 category. You know, but you've got Dr. Ulrich in the pits and a lot of familiar faces, and whatever anybody says, these are all works teams or works assisted teams, and they're effectively battling it out. And it just means that the sharp end of the field is so much more competitive. So if you do have a problem, as soon as you've dropped two or three or four laps, really, your chance of an outright victory is pretty much gone.
And of course, speaking not just only of Porsche, BMW and Audi, Mercedes-Benz are also there battling for a podium position. They were fighting with the Audis for quite a while as well, until they had mechanical failure. So there really is a battle coming from all sides there.
Well, the big prestige German manufacturers, it's a massive race for these guys. Mercedes-Benz, heartbreak for them with the last car. It was literally last 40 minutes, wasn't it? Yeah. And there was those pictures of Christoph Busch with tears in his eyes as the car came in after it made its final pit stop, and, you know, to effectively drop out of contention. You know, those GT3 Mercedes-Benz, very competitive. We sort of raised our eyebrows and wondered whether that and the 458, in fact, would have the reliability, and it seems that they did. Audi are still desperate to win that race, and, you know, you saw the sort of, they had the advantage in numbers, and you saw the sort of effort that they've put into that race, and they still can't win it. But there was, I mean, one thing I will say, I think there is a little bit of of consternation, and it was said by a couple of people to us at RadioLeMans.com that, you know, the GT2 cars really shouldn't be there. And I kind of understand that. I understand why there's an EXP class for something like the hybrid, and possibly even something like the N technology, the Glickenhaus T45 concept. But why do we need to have GT2 cars competing when particularly somebody like BMW and Porsche have GT3 equipment that they could have run instead? And it seems to me that if Farnbacher can convert their GT2 car to an SP, to one of the VLN categories, and run that and run it legally and legitimately in an SP category, then there's no reason that BMW can't run a GT3 or a GT4 version in SP 9 or 10. And as it was, the Ferrari ran in SP 8, I think it was, wasn't it? And even then, that seems to be a little bit unfair when you're running against something like, I mean, that's a full house GT2 car in disguise. And you know, you're running against something like the Aston Martin Zagatos and, you know, the other stuff that's in there.
Aside from the 24 hours of the Nordschleife, the dust has finally kind of settled on the 2011 Le Mans 24 hours. What an incredible race. The battle between Peugeot and Audi, that really did go to the flag. I mean, we were treated to something incredibly special this year.
Do you know, this year's endurance racing calendar, whether it's been the GT3 and GT4 or whether it's been the SEO rules package, has really not failed at all. You know, there's been no disappointment at all in the quality of the racing. Even the American Le Mans series, where numbers are down a little bit, you know, we've had good racing pretty much every event that we've had. The old adage is, of course, as you well know, it only takes two to make a race. And that's probably just as well for the American Le Mans series sometimes. But we've had, and I say that with love, Le Mans this year, you know, we built it up a lot, and sometimes when that happens, you're just setting yourself up for a fall. But it didn't disappoint this year. Obviously, it was the first season of the new rules and regulations, and there's a lot, I think a lot to be discussed and talked about with that. I'm not sure we've still got it right. Clearly the cars are more difficult to drive, and I'm not saying that those type of cars should ever be easy, but we've seen too many times this year prototype drivers either make bad decisions or have decisions made for them when the cars have got away from them. They're clearly not running as much downforce as they used to do, trying to claw back some of the speed.
You can actually tell during coming down to Mulsanne, certain parts of the race, just how skittish they were as well.
Yes, they're running very, very skinny, and you know, when you take 150, 200 horsepower away from them, which is basically what we're being told by the manufacturers, then they've got to get the speed back from somewhere else. They ran pretty much exactly on the ACO's 330 limit over the stints in the race. Audi, certainly the number one car, when it was doing its long runs in practice and qualifying, Dindo was running at 330.6 and Alan was running at 330.4. That's the average times. Everybody gets tied up about the qualifying times, but it's the average time over a stint, not including your in and out lap, that the ACO are really looking at. And Audi ran right on that. Peugeot ran at 335, so we knew pretty early on in the week at Le Mans that there was going to be something of a difference in the race pace of the two major contenders, and that's exactly how it played out. The only thing that we didn't know was the fuel mileage and whether the slightly faster but less economical Audis would work out in their favour. And I seem to remember asking Paul Truswell, our fabulous statistician, at about 4 or 5, maybe a little bit more, 6 hours into the race, when the lead Audi got in and out of the pits without losing the lead. And I said, is that the first time he's done that? And he says, yes. And that was the time that we kind of knew that all things being equal, that it would be Audi's race. Now, at Le Mans, of course, all things are never equal, and you get long periods under safety cars.
As we found with the accidents for both McNish and Rockenfeller.
Yes, exactly. The thing about that was Audi could run very, very, very lean in terms of fuel under the safety car, so they weren't losing any ground to Peugeot, but clearly they weren't getting up the road either. But they seemed to be very, very good. I mean, the thing about the accidents, and I just watched McNish's shunt this morning, and I can still barely look at it again. It's shocking. I'm still not sure what Alan thought he was going to achieve by trying to dive down the inside of the leader. Why he could make the pass.
No, I still have no idea how it didn't go over the tyre barrier. That's what I never understood.
When you see some of the steel pictures, you think, that's carried on and gone straight over into the catch fencing. And of course, we know that didn't happen, thank goodness. You know, I'm not a great proponent of the rear fin on these cars, the central rear fin, but quite clearly, kept the cars on the ground. We saw the Rebellion stay on the ground at Spa, despite the fact that it had clipped the curb going up from Eau Rouge to Radion at full chat when it broke a rear suspension member and then fired it off sideways. Now, certainly, you know, there's something to be said for these rear fins, but when you look at Rotti's crash, there's a part of me that thinks that rear fin acts as a turning vane. And everything happens quicker. First of all, obviously, the cars are more stable at a higher speed. When they get sideways, they don't tend to scrub off enough speed. They actually just go in the direction that they're pointing, which is exactly what happened with Rotti's. McNish's crash was a bit different. He clearly wanted to get airborne, and it was skipping across the front of the gravel trap. But again, what you see is as soon as they get anywhere near sideways, there's no getting them back. And I think that is, we've got to be looked at. We know that Peugeot's had a couple of monster crashes, but they weren't too keen on releasing the data from one in Aragon at the back end of last year. And then when the Nacion ended up so far off the track, it's a test at Paul Ricard that he was actually on the airfield. And we've had unconfirmed reports saying that the car was off the ground for something like 300 metres in terms of its lateral travel, not how high it went, obviously. But there's clearly something about these fins that we don't understand yet, and I'm not clever enough to understand it. The FIA working group who have done it, it's not the ACO, it's not people in sports cars necessarily. And between you and I think that it needs to be looked at more. I think it needs to be refined. I don't think it's necessarily all bad, but I don't think it's necessarily all good. And let's not forget, this is the same set of people who gave us the wonderfully successful DRS system on Formula One cars, and the wonderfully successful Let's Reduce Formula One Downforce so there can be more passing.
After the European Grand Prix the other day, I don't want to talk about Formula One.
Well, apparently the excitement, the GP excitement package, got stuck in Spanish customs and never made it to the track. So.
Yeah, I do believe they're in there with Hispania's dampers still, I think.
If it wasn't for the fact that I was actually watching another race at the time, I probably would have fallen asleep while we were watching that at the Nürburgring. But don't get me on that one.
Heading back now to endurance racing, Aston Martin made their comeback. Very, very difficult times. I don't think that even they would have imagined it would have turned as sour quite as much as it did at Le Mans this year.
Aston Martin is a tough one because, you know, we have very good links with the guys from Aston Martin, both Aston Martin Racing and Aston Martin Cars. And the first thing to point out is that, you know, those are linked but separate organisations. organisations when they go racing. So what we saw at the Nürburgring at the weekend was very much an Aston Martin Lagonda, if you like, that Gaydon, where the cars are actually designed, built and manufactured. That was very much their effort, with the guys who were engineering those cars and even some of the guys who were driving those cars, like Chris Porritt, are production engineers, designers and guys who assemble the Vantages and DBS and the other V12 variants at Gaydon. What we see with the ACO rules cars, the GT2s, and of course the P1 cars, is that that is an Aston Martin Racing, which is an offshoot of ProDrive, and that's down the M40 at Banbury, and that's their operation. Now, the long and the short of the problems that they've had with the BMR1, and we were there at the launch of that car, which wasn't that long ago, and that's the problem. The problem is that, as David Richards has said to us on a number of occasions, when he's been gracious enough to come into the RadioLeMans.com box after the problems that we've seen with the car this season, is they're 6 months behind time, at least. They pushed the button too late. Mm. And one of the reasons behind that is, quite simply, they don't fund their racing in the same way somebody like an Audi or a Peugeot, or even for that matter, somebody like a Rebellion or even some of the better private teams. Basically what Aston do is they have a programme that relies on them selling the X-Works chassis either as soon as they're built or as close to it afterwards to wealthy collectors or Aston Martin aficionados, racing them for a couple of races and then retiring them. And alongside that, they have the second car, the Fernandez Merrick and Premat car. That car is effectively funded by the drivers. And, yeah, OK, we all know that Adrian Fernandez is a fabulous driver, and but his sponsors, Lowe's, pay a huge amount of money. Andy Merrick has got some personal sponsorship that he brings in, and the third driver is exactly the same. He has a banking concern that comes in and puts some money into it. Now, that's a very different business model from someone like Peugeot or Audi. You know, as we've said before, Audi's new car that we were all going on about how new it was at Spa and Le Mans has been running before the last iteration of the previous car, so about 18 months ago. Now, Aston don't have that luxury of doing things that way, because they have to effectively pay for each project as it goes along. And it sounds like I'm defending them, and to a certain extent I am. They're doing all their testing in public, whereas any of the problems that Audi might have had, we've never heard about in the first 6 months of their new car's lives. It's all done behind closed doors, and we haven't even had a sniff of the new car because we're too busy looking at the last iteration of the other one. You know, it's difficult for us, and I do feel for them. It's a great brand, but they're a very, very small car company, and they don't have the millions of marketing and promotional euros to spend on their racing programme as some other people do. The longer term question is, you know, will they get it right? Well, I think they've made some hard decisions, and I think they've made some right decisions. The decisions to miss Spa and take the fine from the ILMC was a good one. They're going to do the same with Imola. They won't be at Imola, and they're going to try and get the car, some reliability in the car, by the time they get to Silverstone. The problem is they're so far behind now that, you know, Michelin are asking them for data on tyres and they can't give them it because they just haven't got any significant running on the car. They haven't even got baseline setups for the car because it hasn't run long enough. And, you know, this is the problem when you've got a limited test programme and basically you're trying to learn about the car and set it up in 2 1.5 hour test sessions, and a half hour or a 20 minute qualifying session before an ILMC race. It's, you know, it, the model's just wrong, isn't it?
Yeah, you can almost say the exact same for the rear end of Formula One at the minute as well.
Well, it's even worse for them because there is a ban on testing. I mean, Aston have been able to go away and test at the, you know, the lower reaches of the Formula One grid. They're not even allowed to do that. Now, we know why that is, but does that mean that the front end of the grid isn't testing? No, of course it doesn't. They're doing it in other ways. Whether it's on the, you know, TV days where they're going out and allegedly doing stuff for their sponsors, whether it's on extra computing power and more simulation days, or just more people working, more clever people working more times. But Nick Damon on Midweek Motorsport has said many times before that the best way to do a bit of testing for Formula One is pick a number of events during the season, and then on the Monday after the Grand Prix, have effectively an open test day. And the codicil for that is you have to run your third driver. You can run as many cars as you want, but your third driver's got to run. And that would give the opportunity for the smaller teams to get some really meaningful running in on a circuit that's rubbered in where they're already there. And it cuts down the financial implications by a massive factor. And I think it's a great idea, and which clearly means that it'll never be adopted. It's far too much like common sense.
We have the Imola 6 hours is coming this weekend. It is a track I absolutely love. It's even more so since they did the work on the final section about 2-3 years ago. It's probably even longer ago now than that. What are your thoughts about this race coming into the weekend, and you know, its potential effect on the ILMS or the LMS or all the championships, whatever it's called?
All of the championships. Well, of course, we have it as a world championship next year, which is an interesting prospect and possibly a conversation for another time. Believe it or not, I've never been to Imola before. Monza is the place that we've been to in the past, and I've been there for a number of different championships, including sports cars. Never been to Imola. Really looking forward to it. It's in a beautiful part of the world. It's a damn long drive, though. I think it'll suit the sports cars. The great thing about these type of tracks is, and the format of the races this year is, no longer is it either 1,000 kilometres or 6 hours. This is a timed race. It's a six-hour race. So we know we're going to get 6 hours of racing around there. We're not going to quite have the biggest field that as we thought, because there's been one or two withdrawals. Oak Racing have decided to pull out. Aston Martin, we've talked about, and there's one or two others as well that are deciding not to go. But it still leaves us, most controversially, of course, the IMSA, the Matmut rather, Peugeot HDI, the Orica car, last year's car, which is actually the championship leader at the moment. I think we've got a really great racing prospect. Now, of course, I would say that because we're covering it live on RadioLeMond.com all the way through the weekend, and I'm not likely to call out rotten fish, am I? But I think the character of the circuit, the fast-flowing nature of the circuit is perfect for sports cars and for the big, big downforce sports cars, our big power and big speed of the sports cars that we have now, and the more slippery, less drag that we have now, rather than the big downforce, should I say, will make for a very interesting battle. I also think the Peugeot have got to certainly pull something out of the fire for the rest of the season, because they, I see what you like about Olivier Canel and Bruno Famin, the two guys at the top of that, but their biggest triumph last year was to be able to go to the Peugeot board after the debacle that was Le Mans and get them to refund and re-up for season 2011. Now, this year at Le Mans, they've got no excuses. They were simply beaten by a car that was better and that took its opportunities better. Peugeot didn't really, in terms of tactics, do anything wrong. They had a plan, they stuck to it, and they were beaten, having pretty much delivered the plan as they expected. They must salvage something from the second half of the season. Otherwise, I really do think that will be a project that is in jeopardy. I can't see Peugeot continually pouring the kind of money that they are into that without getting any reward. And for them, reward, albeit it's very nice to have ILMC champions next year, okay, maybe we get a year, a stay of execution because there's the World Championship, but Peugeot need to go into that World Championship looking like a World Championship potential team, and the need to get a result at Le Mans next year. So the rest of the season, crucial for Peugeot. Audi have got the bumper sticker and the car sticker that everybody wants. They've got, you know, Le Mans winners 2011 to put on the back of every car that they sell from now until this time next year. And I don't think that the fight at the front of the field is going to be anything less exciting than what we've already seen this year. In fact, in some ways, the gloves will come off now. The performance balancing that everyone was worried about before Le Mans is now not an issue. So, as our American colleagues could say, the guys at the front of the field can have at it and basically go and start punching seven shades of whatnot out of each other. And I do think that's what it's going to be like. I think you'll see some new drivers for Peugeot. They sacked Pedro Lamy halfway through the race at Le Mans because...
Very controversial.
That's quite unbelievable. I've spoken to so many colleagues, former colleagues, Portuguese journalists. Now, he's a difficult... Judging by what the Portuguese journals have said, he's not said to me, he's not always the easiest person to deal with. But speaking to people who've driven with him, I'm not going to name anybody, but driven with him quite recently and at Peugeot, they've told me that his attitude within the team and in the car is exemplary. That, all right, he's never, everybody knows he's never going to be the quickest guy in that car, but by fractions, and that he delivers the car back to you. If you tell him to go and put in a lap time, he'll put in that lap time and deliver the car back to you in a steer that you can go out and do your stint. Now, that's the epitome of an endurance driver. So what really went on in the early hours of the morning at Le Mans, or the mid-morning at Le Mans, we might never know, unless Pedro wants to tell the story, because I'm sure Peugeot management won't. But he's gone. Alexander Wurz, another smashing guy, made a mistake which effectively cost that car a shot of the win. They would have finished two or three laps ahead had he not gone off at Indianapolis. I think his future might well be in question. I hope it isn't, because I think he's a real strong attribute and a real guy who can contribute as much out of the car as he can in the car. And anybody who's listened to our Tyler's Long one that Nick Damon did with him at Spa at RadioLeMond.com will get, even though it's a great 40-minute interview, it's barely scratching the surface with Alex, and he's just a great resource for a team. But I've got to think they'll be looking for scapegoats from Le Mans, and I doubt it'll be Canelo or Plamann who will have the rug pulled out from underneath them. So I think you could see two or three changes. I think you might see the reserve driver getting a shot at it. You might even see some names from other parts of motorsport dragged into that team to be given a tryout before the end of the season as they look forward to the World Championship in Le Mans again in 2012.
John, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast this week. Could you just give us a heads up? What is the schedule for Radio Le Mans this week at the Imola 6 hours?
Well, it's fairly easy. If the cars are on the track, we'll be on the air. We guarantee for all of the events that we do that we'll do a minimum of final practice, qualifying, any warm-up, and the race, the whole race live without interruption. Our plan is to do exactly the same as that down at Imola. If we can get the first couple of practice sessions on Friday as well, then we will do. That's going to come down to the facilities down there. But we'll be there in plenty of time. We'll be at the track ready for that first practice session on Friday lunchtime, which is, I think, quarter past midday on Friday, if memory serves, Central European time. And our plan will be to be on air for that, facilities allowing. And all the news will be on the front page of RadioLeMond.com. And, of course, as ever, the great thing about podcasts, as all your listeners know, is that if they can't listen to it live, they can listen to it as live or whenever they want, just by going into the archive or going through iTunes and searching for Radio Le Mans. You can subscribe on there. Beware if you do that, because you will get absolutely everything that we do, and that might be a problem for some of you, although I know a lot of people have already downloaded the whole 24 hours of Le Mans and the whole 24 hours of the Nürburgring to listen to again. I salute all of those, and my hat's off to them, and I can only apologise because I've got no idea. Maybe they put them on speakers in front of the fire to keep the kids away from it. I don't know. It's the only thing I can think of. But thank you very much for the opportunity to come on, and thanks for all the support from your listeners, who I know are our listeners as well, and I hope we'll be continuing to provide them with the service that they clearly so enjoy for many, many more years to come.
John, I will be at Spa for the 24-hour race covering F3. If I get a chance, I'll pop up and say hello. Cheers again.
Cheers, Joe.
And thanks once again to John Heinhoff for joining me on the Park for a Bit podcast. A little bit longer than I anticipated, but it was all good. If you want to follow the Imola 6 hours or any of the Le Mans series races, go to RadioLeMans.com and you'll have a full schedule there. And they will be broadcasting the practices, qualifying, and the races on their radio network. Also, tune in to Midweek Motorsport at 8 o'clock UK time every Wednesday. It's well worth a listen. Fantastic stuff. Thanks also to Eve Hewitt for helping arrange the interview. Wonderful stuff. And I just want to thank you very much for listening in to the Park for a Bit podcast, episode 3. If you want to learn more about the Formula 1 and Motorsports Archive, please just go to www.thef1archive.co.uk, or for a more immediate response or action, just go to Twitter. It's at the F1 Archive on Twitter. Please get in touch with your questions, your suggestions, anything. We take it all in. Wonderful. Thank you very much. And hopefully you'll all hear from me soon. Goodbye.